Okay, so let's begin with a nice story. An intro to the intro. There was a big tzaddik called the Shpaler Zeide. Shpaler is the name of a location, and he was known as a grandfather, as a Zeide. And the reason why he was called the grandfather wasn't because him, compared to the other colleagues, he was the grandfather and they weren't. You know, most people, if they marry, they have kids, they have grandkids, they become grandparents. But the story is that the Baal Shem Tov, in his earlier phase in life, prior to him being 36, when he was a hidden tzaddik, and he made his livelihood by being a floor maker. Really, you didn't make floors then. It was very common in those parts of the world then that people had earth floors, mamish. And you needed to exchange it or put another layer over it every couple of years, however it worked. It was a very simple work. It was a hard, it was a physically laboring work. It's like being a porter. People needed that, but in Yiddish it's called a schlepper, like a nebach, like, you know, this demeaning job. I don't think it was demeaning. It was a hard work. He had a horse and a buggy, and he went to the areas where there was fresh earth, and he would fill up his buggy, and he would take it into the city, into the village, and whoever wanted, he would put down a new flooring for them.
Who was this again?
The Holy Baal Shem Tov. And he worked with his wife. They worked together as a team. It wasn't something that you can do by yourself. And the Baal Shem Tov's horse, he got old and weak, and he was out of a livelihood. And what he heard is that in a certain location, in that vicinity, there was a man, a wealthy man, who not only excelled in hachnasat orchim, by that person having some sort of in, so when people came, you know, there's a limit into how long you can have guests in your home. People have to know their capacity, and many people who want to do the mitzvah of hachnasas orchim with the seichel of respecting boundaries that most people need. So what people would do is that they would have in their home their living quarters separate, and then they would have, like the Horowitzes, you would have, he had an inn, he had many, many, many rooms in which whoever was traveling, who needed a place to stay, they would stay over there. This is free of charge. He was very careful not to allow people of different genders to stay in the same room. This is part of that story. He didn't know if they're married, not married. They can say they're married. Men in this area and women in the other area. And his special, the greatest mitzvah was like this. He made a living. He had mills. Mills that would grind wheat into flour. How do you get the stone to turn? So people would have windmills. People would have water mills. And he would have horse mills. Horse mills means is that a lot of koyach, that you put horses, nebach, not nebach for us, not for them, to walk around. It's a type of labor that took a lot of energy out of these animals. And when they were relatively young, they were like burnt out. They would be very good to be a horse and buggy, but not to turn a mill. And he would have horses the whole time that he would give to the people that would come, that if he would find that they are in need of transportation, you would get a beaten-up car. So they told the Baal Shem Tov, you need a horse. The Baal Shem Tov's horse was really an elder horse. This guy's used horses were young compared to his. So they told him, why don't you go to that guy? And he gives horses. He needed parnasa. Imagine the Baal Shem Tov. So he went with his wife, and he came to that person, and like he was told to sleep in one room. The wife was told to sleep in another wing. And in the morning, the Baal Shem Tov was gifted a horse. Oh, one second, before I step back. So before the happy ending with the horse, the guy, the owner, wakes up in the middle of the night, and it appeared to him that from one of the wings, from the men's section, there was a fire. A fire then was the end of the world. Fire meant, mamash, in a few minutes, your whole thing burns down. He grew up and he got the bucket of water, and he went running out there. There was no fire. He goes back into bed. He lays down. He looks out of his window. A fire. He runs there. There's no fire. When it happened the third time, he realized that the fire is not the physical fire, but something is happening there. and his curiosity got the better of him. And that's the way the story is written. And he looked through the keyhole or through the crack. He looked into the room, and it was the room of the Baal Shem Tov. And next to the Baal Shem Tov was this angelic man who was not of this world, who was shining like a fire, conversing with the Baal Shem Tov. And when he saw that, he was so overwhelmed that he fainted. The Baal Shem Tov heard someone fainting on the other side of his door. It was like a fall. So he woke him up. He told him, why did you faint? He says, why did I faint? Who was that with you? So the Baal Shem Tov told him that if you merited to see him, then you deserve to know who he was. And that was the Maral of Prague. And it was destined in the heavens for his neshama to come back into the world. He needed to come back in. And they were looking for someone to merit hosting the soul of the Maral. And I interjected in the heavens that they should give it to you and your wife. For the level of Achnasas Archim, compounded with the carefulness that you have to separate the genitals. On top of that you give out, you help people like me and make parnasa. A horse meant parnasa, you have a living. He gave people who were to sleep and then he helped them make a living. And this man had no kids before. Him and the innkeeper and his wife. So that was a big bracha. And the Baal Shem Tov told him that I want to ask of you two things. First of all, that when by the bris, he told him, you'll have a son within a year. And by the bris, you should name him Yehuda Leib, because it's the neshama of the Maral. Parenthetically, by Gilgulim, it doesn't have to work that way. You know, the Arizal wrote a whole sefer of Gilgulim, right? Like Moshe was the Gilgul of Hevel. All of the Gilgulim that we know of comes from the Arizal. Well, Moshe is one name, Hevel is another name. Right, that Kayin went into Yisrael. That whole Arizal and Tzipoiron was the reason why they killed each other. Not each other. Kayin killed Hevel because of a woman. Because Kayin was born with one twin sister. Hevel was born with two twin sisters. I'm getting completely off topic. And the ideal then, this would have been such a relief. Imagine, no shidduch issues. The plan A was for no one to die. Once death came into the world, so now people have to be reborn to replace the ones who died. The next plan was that you're born with your zivug. Can you imagine? Everyone is born with twins. And you marry your twin. That was one of the first plans that God had, and that's what happened with Cain and Hevel. And Cain was born with one sister. Hevel was born with two sisters. So Hevel was going to marry both. Cain said, no, I'm the older brother. I should get both. I should get two, not one. And that's what Cain told Hevel, and that neshama of that woman came into Tzipora. And the rectification for Cain was that he gave Tzipora to Moshe. And that's that easy. I'm just giving an example where you, amazing, God, that you have these names. It's people here, they smile, and it's Takei Gavaldik. Even just for the record, that Yisrael was not so giving to Moshe anything, much less his daughter. Yisrael incarcerated Moshe for 7 years. If you think your father-in-law hates you, you have no idea. They just never say it. But the in-law issues, that they were horrible. From when he saw me already, he so much disliked him, he put him into jail.
For how long?
7 years, the Medrash says. Can you imagine? That's crazy. He was like suffered. Moshe Rabbeinu suffered, and he gave him barely nothing to live off. So to rebel against her father Tzipora, to get at her dad, she went ahead and she gave food to Moshe Rabbeinu without his knowledge. And that's one of the stories behind the stories of how Moshe. So it's not that Yisrael was so into Moshe. And at the end, without option, he needed to bring, this is, you know, Vayikach Yisrael went ahead, then he brought Tzipora, Eshes Moshe, he brought her and the kids. That was the ultimate rectification, when he ultimately saw the greatness of Moshe, and even though they were married for a long time, it was only then that he fully was content and was proud of the shidduch that his daughter did. And for people of our generation, the Kana Makim, how careful we have to be that if you see your son-in-law or daughter-in-law, and you guys don't have them yet, you'll have them soon. How, you know, listen, you feel what you feel. You have
the next,
you feel what you feel. And I know that in public, you'll never say that you dislike them. No, you love them. but how careful you have to be. And even if you don't see the qualities that they have, for whatever reason, and you have to learn how to live with that, but at some point you'll see the greatness who they are. But it, you know, it's Basharit. I know a lot of effort that Evan needed to make to calm parents down when they came to complain about the shidduch that their children did. I know this from many people who I heard and how they were besides themselves. How their child, the amazing tzaddik, the perfect person, married such a shidduch, and how did it come to be? And anguish that sometimes happens, which is Maisa Satan, and how firm that Evan used to be in telling the parents to back away. But coming back over here, so this is Yehuda Leib, and the second request the Baal Shem Tov gave, this is a great story. The Baal Shem Tov told this man that I would like to bless your son by Dibris. I'll be there. But since no one knows who I am, make sure that you do not give me any special attention. That's a little bit challenging. How can a no one give a bracha? Who is the no one to give a bracha? What happened was, is that when the son was born, the innkeeper and his wife were waiting for the Baal Shem Tov, and he wasn't showing up. And they were childless for many years. They were wealthy, so everyone came to participate in the simcha and to have a good free breakfast. But the Baal Shem Tov didn't show up, so they delayed the bris. No one knew why. Until he said, "Have the meal." They had the meal before the bris. And when the Baal Shem Tov walked in as a beggar, when he walked in over there, that's when they made the bris. And the chachma of the innkeeper was that he said that being that it took him and his wife all these years to have a child, it would be an honor for them if everyone present can bless their child. So after the bris, whether the father, whether the mother, they walked around towards everyone and they asked everyone to give a bracha. Like this, that would be their excuse of going to the Baal Shem Tov. And they went to the Baal Shem Tov towards the end. In other words, they made the effort for the Baal Shem Tov not to be exposed, that he knew who the Baal Shem Tov was. And the Baal Shem Tov said in Yiddish, that it says in this week's parsha, Va'avraham zaken, va'avram zaken, babayomim. Va'Hashem beirach es Avraham bakoil. The literal translation is that Avram was old. Baba Yomim will leave for a moment. Mamish, literally, he came into his days. That has to be explained. And Hashem blessed Avram with everything. So the Baal Shem Tov says that I was taught by my teacher that Va'avram Zaken means that Avram was a Zayda. Even though that's not the pshat, actually at that point he was not a Zayda, because Yitzchak didn't do the shidduch yet. This pasuk is written prior to the whole looking for Rivka. Avram Zaken means Avram was a Zayda. And I give a bracha to this baby that you will be a Zayda for your people. And people heard it and they found it so humorous that you're calling an 8-day-old baby a Zayda, that it stuck. It became a Zayda. So from when he was 8, he was called a Zayda. Many years later, when he became the big tzaddik in the city of Shpala, so he was known as the Shpala Zayda, which is quite amazing. That's how the name came from. Now, Vavram Zaken, Avram was a Zayda. Baba Yamin, what's Baba Yamin? What does it mean, Baba Yamin? So the Zohar says something beautiful, that he took all of his days with him. He was able to take all of his days with him. This is such a beautiful statement. And I know that Chabad Hasidim use the statement always. Like we are relatively close to Tishrei. And Tishrei is definitely on some level a difficult month. It's a full month, a lot of stuff that needs to happen. When you finish something, there is one way of thinking about it, and that is that it's behind me. Tishrei is behind me. Tishrei is over. Or now I am taking Tishrei with me. And whenever you have some experience that for you had no meaning, certainly if there was an experience which for one was bad, they leave it behind. You say, like, good riddance. I got through that. That's behind me. When one is able to view their life as something important and meaningful, right? Like when you come back from a beautiful vacation experience, yeah, I know it's behind you, but you don't want to leave it behind you. So what you do is that you take it with you. So Avram Zaken Baba Yamim says the Zohar that every single day in his life was a day that he could give an accounting for, and he understood and appreciated the mission, the purpose of every single day. It doesn't mean that he had just good days. No, he understood that whatever the day was, there was a meaning for it, there's a purpose for it, and he took it with him. And that's an awesome statement, that he was a Baba Yamim person. That means every single day had its purpose. That's the expression. The Zohar, not every day was great. Ram Avinu had plenty of difficult days, but his relationship with difficulty was not the way we relate to difficulty, which is get me out of here. No. If you really believe, and he really believed, he was the one that taught the world about Hashgacha Pratis, so every day is given to you by God with whatever it comes with it, and there is something that you have to learn from it. And he didn't split off those days. He took every single day with him. And then the Zohar adds that every day is a garment. And Avraham Avinu was not lacking a single garment. That's a big statement. So let me explain to you. So let me give you words. Words in Kabbalah, and we understand the at least a little bit of what it means. Says the Zohar about the garment that just like the soul, that is something spiritual. What is your neshama? People won't know. And our neshama is in us, like it's giving us life. But the only way it could be a living being interacting in the physical world, it needs a garment as an interface. Today you can say as an avatar, to be able to interact with the physical world. So what garment does the soul have in this world? Physical garment. The body. The body the soul doesn't need a body. The soul needs a body in this world. The soul exists with or without it the same. But the type of interacting that we need to have in this world, we can only have if we have a garment, which is the body. So the body is a physical thing that acts as a levush, which will allow the soul to be here the way we know what being here means. A neshama is here after it passes away, but differently. Okay? Right? Let's flip it. When we go to Gan Eden. So people think, when I go to Gan Eden, since Gan Eden is a ruchnizdika world, we don't need the physical body, so the soul doesn't need a body. It doesn't work that way. The soul needs a levush to interact in the specific Gan Eden that it's going to be in. And here's the chap. That the garment that we are gifted with is given to us by our parents. The body. The garment that we need to be in whichever place we'll be in the next world is a garment that we create while we are alive. And in the positive, that when, particularly when a yid learns Torah and keeps mitzvahs, that is the garment that we will use in the world to come.
Question. So in this world, it's a physical garment, but what's the equivalent in the next world?
Very good. And the fact that we say Torah and mitzvahs, which is in part physical, there's a big thing statement in that. This is all part of the Zohar. So when he says that Avraham Avinu took every day with him, doesn't only mean that he didn't split off the days, even though he had moments that were of great difficulty, his attitude was not good riddance, but no, he took it with him. Most of us cannot do that. Most of us have to first split off, first to heal, because it's so overwhelming, but then ultimately, the ultimate goal is to be able to go back and to look at your whole life's experience and to see how every single day was what you needed. But there's another part of it, is that we have to imbue our days with what we did. Not everything we do is so amazing, and we don't fill our days as much as a greater person could. Avraham Avinu did not allow one day to pass in which he did not put something special in it. Kol yoyim v'yoyim avad avidite. He did something every single day. Just parenthetically, in the earlier years of the Rebbe being a Rebbe, Hasidim traveled to the Rebbe for Yontif. This was considered a Hasidic norm, and even families who were impoverished sacrificed and made the effort to go and be with the Rebbe over Yontif. I'm going back way early. I don't know the exact evolution of airplane travel, but in the early 50s, airplane travel was a lot more expensive relative to the way it became cheaper when we had the type of jets that we use right now. I don't know exactly the history of aviation, but in the 1950s, the price of a ticket was extraordinarily high relative to what people could afford. And the only way Hasidim were able to go to the Rebbe was by chartering a plane. I don't know what price difference they would have right now. I don't think much. But in those days, that was a big difference. So all of these stories that you read that in the 1950s, that Eretz Yisrael, they would charter a plane to go to the Rebbe, the Frenchies would charter a plane. We stopped doing it. Many more people travel because today you go on kayak, you go on orbits, you buy a ticket. I mean, I know that unfortunately the prices went up compared to whatever 2 years ago. But it was, you can buy a ticket, and you can buy today a one-way ticket, and want to make it then. You buy a two-way ticket, it was already cheaper. Chartering a plane was the only way Hasidim were able to afford. So there were chartered planes, which is awesome. A plane, and a whole plane lands. And the name is escaping me, but the Jew that was in charge of chartering the planes in Israel wrote a diary. And it's available in public.
He wrote a diary
of what happened every day, because it's like, you know, what happened, like, oh, it's frustrating. You can relive the experience. Bechlal, Yidden then living in Eretz Yisrael were not, were poor. Chabad Hasidim were very poor, and the experience of being able to afford and to go to the Rebbe was a big thing. And this man, maybe Rabbi Segel, one of them, he's writing, he wrote how what they realized about the Rebbe's schedule, and every second of the Rebbe is used for, is accounted for. He wrote a whole book of that year. I think it was 1951 or 1952. And he told the Rebbe by Yechidus before going back that, I wrote a diary. The Rebbe says, I want to see it. The Rebbe made one emendation to that book, because it wasn't his book. It was the Chassid's book. It wasn't the Rebbe's book to say his experience. But when he wrote that, he realized that the Rebbe it can account for every single rega that I've crossed out rega, and he wrote daka. Mm-hmm. Minute.
What is it?
Minute. Wow. It says, don't say I can account for every second. No, that's exaggeration, but I can account for every single minute. Now you think about that, it's like, it's beyond, beyond, right? Like, we should account for every day, like to fill up every day with, I can account for it. It's like, wow. It doesn't mean there's no downtime. It just means that downtime is also a meaning. But not to waste time. Everything has a purpose. And all of that allows for the neshama to have a better garment. And it is the garment that will determine where we'll hang out in. In other words, the neshama is a piece of God. No one can restrict the soul where you can go, where you can't go. The neshama is inherently worthy. So it's not about the way, you know, when we're younger, you're worthy, do you have enough merits, the way the Zohar words it. It's that in order to be in that place, you need a garment that's congruent with that ambiance. For that, you have to have red glasses. So it needs to have blue glasses. So you have to have them. And it's not, and who gives it to you? You give it to you. You're avoided over here. So he was a Baba Yamun Jew. Every day was accounted for, every moment was accounted for, everything was filled with what it needed to fill, and therefore the Zohar says he wasn't missing a single garment.
Can I ask a question? Do non-Jews have the peace of God? It's just a different...
First of all, let's go brief. I want to take one little step back. The Rambam writes clearly that Chasidei Umas HaOlam, which means a good Gentile, the way the world understands, I just want to be a good person. All right. I know it should be a bit more elaborated. That is something that's universal. It's not uniquely Jewish. For a Jew to say, I just want to be a good person, is degrading one's Judaic soul. It's splitting off, which is a big sacrilegious approach. Mm-hmm. But as a human being, we're meant to be good, and good people have a chelek lo'olam haba. And which means that they have a portion also in Gan Eden, which would mean, according to what we're saying, the same concept.
This is for non-Jews.
For non-Jews, mm-hmm. is that in order for them to be able to be in whichever environment they would aspire to be to, they have to have the right avatar. You have to have the right goof. It's like to be in that environment. Now, all this is problematic, and someone just mentioned that the problematic is that my soul needs a physical body. I get it, because I'm in a physical world. But my mitzvahs, so I gave tzedakah. Now I get it, the intent is ruchnis, but the mitzvah is not the intent. If I intend to give tzedakah and I don't give it, I didn't do the mitzvah. How is that a garment for the soul? Like it's so gashmi. The mitzvahs almost, not all of them. I know we have a few mitzvahs that are chovat halevavot, right? Like believing in God and loving God and being in awe of God. I get that. That's already... At least it's a non-tangible, but most mitzvahs are about doing or not doing. There's another Zohar that the Alter Rebbe links together. And he says, how the Zohar is asking, how did Moshe Rabbeinu, as a living human being, survive 40 days and 40 nights, three times, without eating or drinking? How did that work? How do you understand that? Now, we don't even try to...
He went up also.
Huh?
And what does it mean he went up?
What does it mean he went up? So the Zohar says something so important. And I'm happy you're asking that, because I was never taught that. Like, I was thinking, what does it mean he went up? And they remember that. And then when he didn't come down and they looked up and they saw an image of his body. Now, let me just take a pause. I can tell you what going up means. I think we shared it last week in your home. Like someone here shared, Rabbi Smith's father, that in Yechidus, the Rebbe had an Aliyas Neshama. It means he was in the middle of Yechidus, and the Rebbe that was always sitting, never leaned back in public, ever, mamish, ever. The Rebbe leaned back, but very mindfully. The Rebbe put his head to his right side, and he says the Rebbe became white, not humanly white, and he was overcome with a fear. The Rebbe was checked out. And then a few minutes later, the way color came back, the way he said, the way he did it, like mindfully put his head back where it belongs, opened up his eyes and kept on talking to them. So that we know what it means, that a person is able to project their neshama into another world, the ruchnias, I can imagine what that is. You know, you can even look at someone when they're sleeping. You know, their body is here, but they're not here. So for you, or when a person is daydreaming, right? If you ever were a teacher, like 90% of your class, they're not there. They're there, but they're not there. They're someplace else. But by Moshe Rabbeinu was more than that. Like, no, but and where did his body go? Oh. So the Zohar writes like this. The Zohar writes that there was the Torah says that there was a cloud on top of Har Sinai. The cloud enveloped his body. It went surrounded his, it's like hugged his body. Like a dense, foggy cloud was around not just Moshe Rabbeinu, but the whole top of the mountain, including him. And that anan allowed Moshe Rabbeinu's body to get sustenance from ruchnias. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't that he was getting a liquid from the cloud, that the cloud served as a levush, not for his soul. For his body, in that type of cloud, was able to get sustenance from something completely not Gashmi. So that he went to the heavens, I know what that means, he went to the heavens, he had Aliyas Neshama. All these stories of the Baal Shem Tov, he was gone, his body was in a cloud. And actually, that's the meaning of Rashi. Now when you hear this, you look inside the Rashi, that when we thought that he's not coming back, remember that, we made the egel. So Rashi says that the Satan confused everyone by allowing us to see an image of his body. What the Satan did is that he created a little opening in that cloud. So when people looked up the mountain, they actually saw what appeared to be a lifeless body. We saw his actual body and it was lifeless. Like,
it wasn't an image.
No, now you get it. It was an image because it wasn't him, because he wasn't there. In other words, when a person passes away, their body is not them, just their body. They saw his body. But how did the body survive? The body survived through the levush of a cloud. So you can have a physical cloud that allows something physical to connect to something spiritual. All of the mitzvahs that we do is that. It's not as tangible. Once you did it, while you're doing it, it's even more tangible. But that's the cloud.
Is that the same cloud they had in the desert when the Jews were walking?
That it could be of the same universe, yeah. But nothing like that cloud that Moshe Rabbeinu had. Mm-hmm. And the end of the Chumash ends that there was a big cloud surrounding even the Mishkan, and God made a shvil for him to enter. Mm-hmm. There's something about a fog that is representative of the Shekhinah being present. It's a mystical. There's some mysticism. I don't want to get completely off. You have just to know
it's
other.
It's an eternal thing because it's a mist. It just goes
mist.
On.
So you see eternity. Let me say, it could be tomorrow. I know that other Hasidic rebbes smoke a pipe. Ever heard these stories?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's big. These are big stories. And they don't smoke a pipe because they're looking for tobacco or who knows what people say they have in there. No. There's something. This I know from Brazil. There was a big tzaddik. There's something with smoke. There's something that someone who knows what they're doing does with smoke that they mamish. All these stories. I can have so many stories. I remember as a kid, the Menachem Mendel of Haradok went to the Holy Land. That we know. That means the earlier, he was the teacher of the Alter Rebbe. He was from the elder students of the Maggid. The Maggid passed away. Menachem Mendel of Haradok made a mass Hasidic aliyah to Israel. With the deal that every family that goes will have a family here to support them. So whoever wants to move to Israel, find a family here that's going to support you and go gezuntahit. No, thank God we don't need that. And that's the way, that was called Koilel Hasidim. And then the Alter Rebbe fortified it and he made a specific for Chabad, Koilel Chabad. Koilel Chabad, which now is a soup kitchen, began as the Jews out of Israel giving specific monies to support families who chose to live there for them to be able to live. Because no one made a living there. They came to Israel and there was a lot of persecution from the Yerushalmis. Those Yerushalmis, they didn't like the Hasidim from Eastern Europe. It didn't work. And they were looking to find themselves. And they found themselves in Tveria. And we have letters. Who was in Tveria? Sfardim. And they were humble. And he wrote that finally they felt at home. So he lived in the Tveria. And this Rav Nachman Haradoker, every Erev Shabbos, would smoke a pipe facing the Kinneret. That was his minhag. And there's a story that one out of Shabbos, he was so intensely in his spiritual experience, smoke a pipe and they look at the smoke and he was not here, and his face became red, burning fire. There was a godly fire on him and everyone said, oh, something is happening. And they were waiting and waiting, and it was mamash before candlelighting. He never took so long. And finally, candlelighting, he got up, he took his pipe and he threw it into the Kinneret. And he davened the way it was Simchas Torah. And they asked him, what happened? So he said that the monies that were raised, he said like this, that when we daven, listen to these words. When we daven, even though the prayers go up through the place of the Holy Temple, until today, but all of the prayers from people that live out of Israel are contaminated. And prior to them making their ways to the Yerushalayim, to go to God, they have to go through the Kinneret to be toiveled. Mm-hmm. Why do they have to be toiveled? It's beautiful. He said like this. He says that in the desert, there was a stone. Lahavdil, how people make choizik, the rolling stone. That comes from us. Mm-hmm. That there was a stone that rolled with us in the desert. That was like a sieve. That means it was a stone probably the size of this table, which is a relatively big stone. It went with us on its own, rolled it, but it was filled with holes. And when we were walking, it was just a rolling stone. Whenever we stopped, water. Guys, there was water for millions of people and animals from this stone. Be'era shel Miriam. right? And then Miriam passed away, and the stone just became a stone, and then Moshe Rabbeinu hit it, and it went back to doing what it needed to do. What happened to that stone? Who knows? Where is the rolling stone? So this we have even in the Gemara, that when Yeshua took us into Israel, it went into Yam Kineret. And every Matzah Shabbos, it opens itself up, and it gives forth a little bit of Mayim, and that somehow penetrates all of the waters in the world, and that's why there's an inyan on Matzah Shabbos to take a shower, to go into water, because in that water you're gonna get a remnant, a little shirayim of the Be'era Shel Miriam. When the Rebbe spoke about this in a Fabring, and that was in the early 80s. This is not to be done, but we were kids, we were teenagers. So everyone in 770, it caught on fire. So people decided that they took buckets, and everyone got a bucket of water over their head. Because the Rebbe Gezak, that it says somewhere, that on Matzah Shabbos, you're supposed to go into water.
My mother would give us water to drink.
Matzah Shabbos? This is it.
I heard the urn that you should take from the urn.
Put new water in the urn.
It's a Matzah Shabbos. So he said that now it's because of the Be'eder Shel Miriam, that water is special.
That's from the well.
From the well of Miriam. It's called a stone.
New water in there.
It's a spring coming from Gan Eden, that water. That's why so whatever the contamination of Chutz La'aretz, it needs to be purified. It goes into Teveri.
I'm lost.
You're lost? This is, okay.
What with Matzah Shabbos and
Be'er Miriam? A side note, just to know that there's the Be'er of Miriam in there.
Give your kids more to Matzah Shabbos.
And there's some additional Ruchni Yizdika power imbued in water.
Okay.
All because the waters are somehow connected, and it all comes from Teveri. In other words, the Kineret has a very important place in Yiddishkeit. Aside of it being a beautiful body of water, and aside of Teveri being one of the four holy cities, but it's a lot more than that. The Be'eder Shel Miriam is something physical that's tapping us. We're speaking about the interface between this world and the next. There's something coming from another world, coming through Teveri. And because of the power of the Kineret, because of the Be'eder Shel Miriam, the Kineret didn't have that before we entered Israel. All of our prayers have to go be toiveled in the Kineret. From there they go to Yerushalayim. The Kineret isn't so keen of toiveling from the perspective of the Kineret when it sees all these prayers coming to it with all the contaminations and all of the stuff we have and all of the Shiloh Lishmas. Don't think it's so exciting to embrace our prayers. That's what Menachem Ben Lohardok is saying. But since Jews that live in Chutz La'aretz support Jews that live in Israel, that's the key. Because of the tzedakah, the Kineret is mekabel every Jew's prayer. And there, since it accepts it and it gets purified, it ships it to Yerushalayim and it goes to God. What happened is that the Koil Chabad, the Koil Chasidim, was collected. Don't forget there was a war between the Russians and the Turks. The Ottoman Empire was controlling the Holy Land. They thought they were controlling the Holy Land. So sending money from Russia and from Ukraine and from Poland to Israel was illegal. It was not a normal endeavor. And the way they did it is that they collected the money. They had a trusted person who would go once a year with very expensive coins and jewelry that he used, things that were not so big, and he would take that and he would deliver it to whoever were the representatives of that account in Israel. So he's saying, what Achmel Harodok said is that right before Shabbos, he says the shliach came to Constantinople. He was seeing that because of his pipe. I'm just going through the smoke. What this guy is saying. He says, and there was a robber that knew that he's coming with money, and they held him up, and they stole the money, and they killed him. He said, I'm watching this. And the disaster, he says, first of all, they killed a Jew. The disaster was that all of these families in Israel are dependent on that money. We need that money. And the biggest disaster, from his perspective, he's a holy man, he says, now the Kineret, I was watching as the Kineret was saying, without the tzedakah, I don't want to live, I'm not dealing with you, Chutz La'aretz, Nick, you guys, you want to, hey, you come to Israel. If you live out of Israel, you're shalom, you stay out. So he says, he says that I met Miriam. Imagine this Jew, and we davened. And God brought about that uncorrupted police people, they found these ganavim, and they recuperated the money, and they resolved. They knew that this came from the Jewish community. And the moment that happened, he says, it was Shabbos, I knew that everything is going to be fine, and the Knesset is back open in business. All of that is from smoking a pipe.
So why did he throw the pipe in?
Because it was a Shabbos. He was throwing it in a good, he was excited. It was like a mission accomplished. Because it's not the pipe. And it's not the tobacco. It's the smoke. Coming back to the onan. So what I want to say like this. That there is a contradiction over here. There's an amazing contradiction. It says in Pirkei Avos, Yafa shah achas b'tshuva u'masim tovim. Which means that 1 hour of learning Torah and or doing mitzvahs in this world is better than the whole world to come.
This is considered learning Torah.
Yeah, we're learning Torah. But here's the question. The question is that the Zohar is telling you that our Torah is to make a garment. Our mitzvah is to create a garment which will allow you to go into Olam Haba. What does that imply? That Olam Haba is the main neighborhood. Yeah, we need garments. So you're over here, we're in the shmata business. We're making garments, and then we will be... It doesn't fit with the Zoya. Right?
Or all the Gilgulim stories, because if you come back, then what's the point?
Meaning?
Well, you work very hard here to go there, and then over there they bring you back here to work again.
So what's the point?
Oh,
okay. The question is, which place? Where is the place to be?
Yeah, what's the point?
Where would you want to be if you would have the power to choose? Where would you want to be?
I haven't been there, so I...
No, you don't remember. You don't remember. Okay. You don't remember. But the Torah tells us a lot about what's there.
Yeah, but we do everything we can to stay here, though.
100%. So the Alter Rebbe says like this. He says these are deep ideas. He explains like this. There is what you experience, and then there is what God experiences in your experience. Very different. Our experience of God, our experience of what is much greater there than here. Much.
One more time. Our experience.
You experience yourself being alive.
Okay.
I'm asking.
Yeah.
Yeah. What is life? We don't know. It's a mystery. There are many things that we have over here. That we know that we have it, but we don't know what it is. In the next world, we will actually not only experience being alive, but we will experience what is alive. What is life? And that change is so profound that if we're going to use the word pleasure, the type of pleasure that we have access to here is nothing in comparison to the type of pleasure that we will have in Gan Eden, simply because we don't only have a thing, but we know, we experience what the thing is. Life is godliness. A word for us, it means nothing, and if you had a bad religious experience, it's not a negative word. Life is God, but we don't experience God. We experience life. We're very shallow. We don't have access for our experience to feel what is. We don't. That's from our perspective. Any garment that is able to interface between two things that are very different, right? A cloud somehow connected life to the body of Moshe. The mitzvah, which is something physical, is going to help us interface who's us in Gan Eden. Any interface must be greater than both parties that it is interfacing with. If two people are having a disagreement, the one who's able to bridge the gap, that person has to have something that's greater than both to be able to do it. Whatever that cloud was, that cloud is greater than Gashmias and on some level greater than Ruchnias. Almost like a manifestation of God, who's not limited with anything, so he can bring together two opposite things. God's experience of my mitzvah, from God's perspective, is unbelievably great. And God has no such experience with me in Gan Eden at all. Legamri. That's the meaning. There are no mitzvahs in the world to come. There are no mitzvahs. We do not keep mitzvahs. When it says that we learn Torah, that means we begin to understand everything that we learned about over here. All of the Torah that we learned over here, so we know the words. I know life. I don't know what life is. However much wisdom you think you grasp over here, it's nothing in comparison to what you'll understand over there. But God's experience of, wow, of nachas, of pleasure, of something happening, only over here. So which world is greater? Well, from my perspective, the world to come is greater. When people suffer and you tell them, well, at least they're out of their suffering and the world to come, it's not a sheker statement just to make them feel good. From a person's perspective, if we were to remember how we felt in Gan Eden, and you would look at how you feel right now, you felt much better over there. Can't compare. You, me, my experience. If I were to look at God's experience of me being here, and God's experience of me being there, God has an experience with me only over here.
Is it experience or relationship?
An experience and a relationship. An experience of nachas, of pleasure. There's something that Hashem has from us being over here.
So then what's the relationship there?
With God? It's
or it's just a complete integration.
Not a mist. It's called a reward. Reward meaning that since I gave God pleasure, God wants to give me pleasure. So he can do it a lot better there than here. Whatever we do for God here, God reciprocates over there. Mamish, that direction. So it's there is taka the place in which God is doing for you. And this is the world in which you're doing for God. This is simple one-on-one chassidus. So where is it better? So that's why we are so adamant, chassidim, that people who advocate too much about the world to come are very selfish. Spiritual, but selfish. If it's about me, there is better. If it's about God, then for God it's much better over here. With me being here doing mitzvahs. Obviously, if I don't do mitzvahs, I hurt him. I insult him. I, so to say, get him upset. But I can make him happy. I can do tshuva. Now let's be real. What would you choose? What's better for you or what's better for God?
Would rather be dead or alive? Or I want to be with my kids, you know?
If you take that out of the equation, I want to be real, but not that real. Like, we're not selfless people. We people like us. What would you choose if you really would be given the choice?
Here.
Huh? Just this question. Would you choose something? Would you choose to be involved in and to live with all for either my experience or for God's experience? Which one would you choose?
Would have to choose?
If you were to have to make such a choice, what would you choose? You see, it's nice theoretically to be very altruistic, but like be'emes, like what would a person choose?
Here.
Huh?
Here.
For you, it's better over there. So forget about here or there. Just this is a choice. What would you prefer?
I don't think I can give an honest answer.
Very good.
Yeah. I'm being real.
Being real.
What would you choose?
The Alter Rebbe says something beautiful. The Alter Rebbe says like this, is that if we were to experience a little bit of the pleasure of that world, there's no way that we would be able to choose God. We wouldn't be able to. Not for a tzaddik, for people like us. But since we don't know what that is, so we can really choose God over ourselves because we don't know what we're foregoing.
And maybe we get an experience for a split second down here, so you get that split second feeling of, okay, that's what I want.
The more you get that experience, the harder it will be for you to choose God. If you have to make such a choice.
And God in being the practical way of being.
Living here, even though we're living it, we don't know what we're doing. We don't feel inspired. We don't feel connected. Look at our lives. I'm not minimizing. Okay, of course, we feel to some degree, but it's nothing in compared to there. There is an irony, the Alter Rebbe argues, that the greater the person, the greater your spiritual development happens, the more you become developed, the much more challenging it is for you to be selfless, because the ruchnis dika selfishness is so intoxicating. And dafke, when we are living in darkness, which means most of us, that you have a little taste of a little shiraim of a shiraim of a shiraim, but it's not here. We are able, it's possible even for people like us to say, listen, I'm happy. One mitzvah here is even better than the whole world to come. People that are on a lower level have a much greater advantage over people that are on a higher level. Much. Which is why the Baal Shem Tov honored simple people. Because he really saw them as being closer to God, because they are closer to God. And when people are anguishing of why don't I have a Ruach Nisdik experience? Why is it that a whole Yom Kippur come and go and I had 2 moments, if I had 2 moments? Why? Like, and everything else was so not holy. I was hungry and I had a headache and Yom Tov, and the whole Yom Tov becomes about this meal and that insult and that not appreciation. Like it becomes so. The advantage of it is that when we are completely limited, we are able to make sense of everything by coming to a truth, which is, this is not about me. And I'm happy that God is getting something out of it, because I'm not, almost. And the more I begin to experience great ruchnisdik experiences, then the living over here becomes very, very difficult. Even though I believe that God gets what he needs from me here and not in the world to come. And therefore, let me conclude with a great story. You should know that in the Hasidic world, there are many things that we do that are al pi Kabbalah, that in the earlier generations, the unworthy did not do. I know that boys and men, we wear 2 pairs of tefillin. You go back in the previous Rebbe's times, we did not wear 2 pairs of tefillin before you got married. Like, who are you? You're not worthy of it. Let me go back into the Rebbe Rashab. The Rebbe Rashab, the fifth Chabad Rebbe, was the one in the Chabad world that when he washed for bread, he would wash his hands 3 times consecutively on each hand. 3 times to the right, 3 times to the left. According to the basic letter of the law, either you have 1 long wash on one hand and 1 on the other, or even better, 1-2, 1-2. I'm sure that until today, in many different Jewish communities, frum, when they wash for bread, 1-2 and 1-2.
That's how it is in the Lichfish world.
2 and 2. Yeah.
And what is
the
Chabad to do?
The Rebbe Rashab began to wash. Now, there is, everything needs to have a halachic source. There's someone called the Hago'as Ashri. lived around 800 years ago. He was the one that wrote about that not only to do a third one.
But is it in Chabad to do three in a row or to alternate?
Well, we do three. We do consecutive. We do in a row.
Okay.
We're speaking about before bread. I'm not talking about in the morning when you wake up. But he went from two to three.
But when you wake up, you alternate?
Everyone does six and everyone alternates. That is non-negotiable.
Okay.
We have to wash six times. Before bread, really it could be even one, but it became the norm two. And then Abba Rasha began to one, two, three. Then one, two, three on the other hand. And two people saw that. Because these great tzaddikim, they didn't eat in public the way we eat in public. So one was a great chassid. He was a scholar and he was a ruchni yizdika person, a great man. And one was a simple guy. And they both were Hasidim, and they both said, wow, if the Rebbe does it, we're beginning to do it. And they both began to wash that way. And they told other people that that's the way the Rebbe does it. The Rebbe right away called him the great Hasid. And he admonished him, and he told him, why are you washing three times? He says, Rebbe, you did it. He says, I'm not pleased when people begin to do what I do. He told him, are you on this level? Do you know what this means? Did you do all of the steps prior that I did for you to do, for you to go there? Give him a whole speech. Okay? But to the simple chassid, not a word. Why? And that's, by the way, that's consistent. You should know that there used to be in the Hasidic world, I'm sure a lot of this still prevails today in the Haredi world. You have the basic halacha, and then you have to be a chassid, to go beyond the letter of the law. All right? Going beyond the letter of the law sometimes was viewed as an act of arrogance, as an act of hypocrisy. You're being the big tzaddik, you're fasting Monday and Thursday, and you're being mechalel Shabbos. So when it comes to halacha, even if someone, God forbid, is not keeping Shabbos, well, at least he's davening. We have to do all of it. So if I'm not doing all of it, at least I'm doing half of it. But when it comes to going beyond the letter of the law, it used to be the attitude, first do the law, and then go beyond the letter of the law. The Rebbe changed that, and the Rebbe explained this, connected to the Maimer that we're learning. The Rebbe says that when people were genuinely experiencing a spiritual experience with God, then there's a seder, there's an order. You have to be worthy of it. Because of what God wants of our generation, which is purposefully to have a very limited experience with God. We have a very limited experience, all of us. Especially in Yiddishkeit. We do it based on pure emunah. And we do it for God. I'm not doing it for me. So if it feels good, if it doesn't feel good, if I understand or not, the tekken makes no difference. That's the way we are today. This is what God wants. I'm doing it for God. The disadvantage is that it's very difficult to live in the dark. It's painful. Like, why don't I feel anything? What's wrong? There's a disconnect. The beauty of it is that dafke people that are simple in their ruchniyazdika development are people that are humble with the knowledge that I don't get it. Our Yiddishkeit, I don't get it. Ask any person davening. Do you always feel the davening? Even people that daven, like you said, a little bit if they're lucky. Some people. To have a beautiful davening every morning, I don't know people that have that anymore. So there's the advantage is I'm doing this for God. And once you reach the level that I'm doing it for God, then you're worthy to do the greatest things. So the great scholar, the great person, if you would be very developed from previous generations, then you wouldn't put on Abeinu Tam's tefillin until you're married, and you wouldn't do certain things that you women do, whatever it is. You know, api alocha, you go to the mikveh, you go under the water twice. Today, who knows what? I see by the men, 300 times. Like, who are you? Who are you? No, today, any chap, anything that ever would say, just to conclude that there was a story in the Gemara between different chachamim asking each other, what is this world compared to? So one guy gave a great answer. One guy says that the world is compared to a wedding feast. Now, this guy was very poor, so there was pashut no food. What happens when you're invited to a wedding? So when you come to a wedding, when you're poor, when you have no food at home, the expression in Aramaic was grab and eat and grab and drink. Because soon the wedding is over and there'll be nothing left. And what he meant to say is that chap any mitzvah you could. Chap any mitzvah you could. Even if there's something that's beyond the letter of the law. Minik chasidis. And a person will say, I'm a hypocrite. You're kidding. I'm struggling with the basics here. No, don't have that attitude. Because from God's perspective, or from my perspective, I'm not okay. I'm not justifying my lack in many areas. But if I'm only looking at what's in it for God, anything that God likes is good for God. Anything. And this attitude is going to bring Mashiach. And not, am I worthy of going into the Rebbe? Do you know that when I grew up already, not everyone walked by the Rebbe. They were afraid. They felt unworthy. I didn't prepare myself. And as the time went on, the Rebbe fought against that attitude. You have an opportunity, come see me. You have an opportunity today to go to the oil. I don't know a guy that says, ooh, I'm not going to go. I didn't prepare. 40 years ago, I had that amongst my chaverim. Person says, if I didn't, whatever their thing was, good things, if I didn't do this and that, I didn't learn chitas for a week, how am I showing up? All of that is only truthful if we're dealing with greater people that have a real relationship, that experience things. And if you have the capacity to experience and you do it wrong and you won't have the experience, it's going to be a downer. For us, we don't expect an experience. No one I know expects an experience. We hope. We don't expect it. No one is saying, oh my God, Yom Kippur went. God, I'm angry with you. Yom Kippur went and I felt nothing and therefore what? You're going to do sukkahs. Won't change anything. That's called simple. The simplicity and the tmimuzdekait of the people of our generation is connected to our deficiency of our ruchniyuzdekait development. And the advantage is that we are able, in spite of the fact that we know that Gan Eden is such a lofty world, and who knows what, and it's amazing, and there's pleasure, and all of that and the other, Yafa, even selfishly, as I'm saying, the Alter Rebbe felt that we are able to conclude, I would rather be here. Because I really don't know what's there. And the greater tzaddikim that knew that's there, and they were able to go there every now and then, because of that, they had a much harder time choosing to be here. Much harder time. Even though your tzaddik should be selfless, let's be real. Who wants to give that up? You know, people wanted to be near the Rebbe in the earlier years, and the Rebbe wanted people to go out on shlichus. The earlier Hasidim had a very hard time leaving. I know that. The later Hasidim did not have a hard time leaving. You know why? Not because we were greater Hasidim. Because even when we were there, we didn't experience what the previous generation experienced. So if I'm not having the experience anyways, I might as well do the job. If someone goes to Israel and they have a ruchnik zdik experience in Israel, for example, it'll be very hard for them to come back. How can you give that up? Someone goes to Israel and they don't have a ruchnizdik experience. It was a nice vacation, beautiful. It's much easier to come back, to do the avodah of the hashgacha process that we're living over here. It's much easier. And that person can easier conclude that it doesn't matter that I'm not within holiness. I'm on my mission. We can choose mission over inner joy. We are able to do it because we lack a lot of inner joy. And that's the upside of Galus. That only a Jew in Galus is able. We're learning about Gan Eden and how great it is, and you need garments and all these Gavaldika stories. And we are very easily able to be happy and content of where we are because we only hear the stories. We don't have that experience. So we can conclude that for God, this world is better than the world to come. And therefore, I'm it for God. That's the highest, that's the greatest we can get in
God, this world, so we should want to be in this
so
world.
So therefore, we can even want to be in this world, yeah. Mm-hmm. We're not enticed by the other world because we don't know it. Mm-hmm. If you were to have an otherworldly experience, you would have a much harder time.
Mm-hmm. But the goal, ultimately, would be able to be combined the two here.
That would be Mashiach. That would be Mashiach on all levels. And you're so right. That's
I'm
Mashiach.
Saying without Mashiach, like that's the build up to get to Mashiach in some level, to combine the two at some, like obviously not all the time, because that's not realistic being that we're down on this world, but to be able to combine the joy, the spirituality and the holiness together with the mission. It's just a point.
I hear what you're saying. Halavai, that maybe that's part of the redemption. Maybe that's a personal redemption moment. Yeah. When your highs are not that high, it gives you the inspiration to be very content with your low, if there's purpose in your low.
There is purpose. I know there is.
So Hashem should give us greater contentment in our purpose.
Amen.
And to them, because when we have that, we're more motivated. Then we do the right thing. Because anyways, I'm here. I'm not here for me. I might as well go all the way. Do what God wants for me all the way.